used by the researchers at MIT. Rather than rats, however, Schultz was interested in monkeys like Julio, an 8-pound macaque with hazel eyes who had a very thin electrode inserted into his brain that allowed Schultz to observe neuronal activity as it occurred. One day, Schultz positioned Julio on a chair in a dimly lit room and turned on a computer monitor. Julio's job was to touch a lever whenever colored shapes, small yellow spirals, red squiggles, blue lines, appeared on the screen. If Julio touched the lever when a shape appeared, a drop of blackberry juice would run down a tube hanging from the ceiling and onto the monkey's lips. Julio liked blackberry juice. At first, Julio was only mildly interested in what was happening on the screen. He spent most of his time trying to squirm out of the chair. But once the first dose of juice arrived, Julio became very focused on the monitor. As the monkey came to understand, through dozens of repetitions, that the shapes on the screen were a cue for a routine, touched the lever, that resulted in a reward, blackberry juice, he started staring at the screen with a laser-like intensity. He didn't squirm. When a yellow squiggle appeared, he went for the lever. When a blue line flashed, he pounced. And when the juice arrived, Julio would lick his lips contentedly. As Schultz monitored the activity within Julio's brain, he saw a pattern emerge. Whenever Julio received his reward, his brain activity would spike in a manner that suggested he was experiencing happiness. A transcript of that neurological activity shows what it looks like when a monkey's brain says, in essence, "I got a reward." Schultz took Julio through the same experiment again and again, recording the neurological response each time. Whenever Julio received his juice, the "I got a reward" pattern appeared on the computer attached to the probe in the monkey's head. Gradually, from a neurological perspective, Julio's behavior became a habit. What was most interesting to Schultz, however, was how things changed as the experiment proceeded. As the monkey became more and more practiced at the behavior, as the habit became stronger and stronger, Julio's brain began anticipating the blackberry juice. Schultz's probe started recording the "I got a reward" pattern the instant Julio saw the shapes on the screen before the juice arrived. In other words, the shapes on the monitor had become a cue not just for pulling a lever, but also for a pleasure response inside the monkey's brain. Julio started expecting his reward as soon as he saw the yellow spirals and red squiggles. Then Schultz adjusted the experiment. Previously, Julio had received juice as soon as he touched the lever. Now, sometimes the juice didn't arrive at all, even if Julio performed correctly. Or it would arrive after a slight delay. Or it would be watered down until it was only half as sweet. When the juice didn't arrive, or was late or diluted, Julio would get angry and make unhappy noises, or become mopey. And within Julio's brain, Schultz watched a new pattern emerge. Craving. When Julio anticipated juice but didn't receive it, a neurological pattern associated with desire and frustration erupted inside his skull. When Julio saw the cue, he started anticipating a juice-fueled joy. But if the juice didn't arrive, that joy became a craving that, if unsatisfied, drove Julio to anger or depression. Researchers in other labs have found similar patterns. Other monkeys were trained to anticipate juice whenever they saw a shape on a screen. Then researchers tried to distract them. They opened the lab's door so the monkeys could go outside and play with their friends. They put food in a corner so the monkeys could eat if they abandoned the experiment. For those monkeys who hadn't developed a strong habit, the distractions worked. They slid out of their chairs, left the room, and never looked back. They hadn't learned to crave the juice. However, once a monkey had developed a habit, once its brain anticipated the reward, the distractions held no allure. The animal would sit there, watching the monitor and pressing the lever over and over again, regardless of the offer of food or the opportunity to go outside. The anticipation and sense of craving was so overwhelming that the monkeys stayed glued to their screens, the same way a gambler will play slots long after he's lost his winnings. This explains why habits are so powerful. They create neurological cravings. Most of the time, these cravings emerge so gradually that we're not really aware they exist, so we're often blind to their influence. But as we associate cues with certain rewards, a subconscious craving emerges in our brains that starts the habit loop spinning. One researcher at Cornell, for instance, found how powerfully food and scent cravings can affect behavior when he noticed how Cinnabon stores were positioned inside shopping malls. Most food sellers locate their kiosks in food courts, but Cinnabon tries to locate their stores away from other food stalls. Why? Because Cinnabon executives want the smell of cinnamon rolls to waft down hallways and around corners uninterrupted, so that shoppers will start subconsciously craving a roll. By the time a consumer turns a corner and sees the Cinnabon store, that craving is a roaring monster inside his head, and he'll reach unthinkingly for his wallet. The habit loop is spinning, because a sense of craving has emerged. There is nothing programmed into our brains that makes us see a box of donuts and automatically want a sugary treat, Schultz told me. But once our brain learns that a donut box contains yummy sugar and other carbohydrates, it will start anticipating the sugar high. Our brains will push us toward the box. Then, if we don't eat the donut, we'll feel disappointed. To understand this process, consider how Julio's habit emerged. First, he saw a shape on the screen. Over time, Julio learned that the appearance of the shape meant it was time to execute a routine. So, he touched the lever. As a result, Julio received a drop of blackberry juice. That's basic learning. The habit only emerges once Julio begins craving the juice when he sees the cue. Once that craving exists, Julio will act automatically. He'll follow the habit. This is how new habits are created. By putting together a cue, a routine, and a reward, and then cultivating a craving that drives the loop. Take, for instance, smoking. When a smoker sees a cue, say a pack of Marlboros, her brain starts anticipating a hit of nicotine. Just the sight of cigarettes is enough for the brain to crave a nicotine rush. If it doesn't arrive, the craving grows until the smoker reaches, unthinkingly, for a smoke. Or take email. When a computer chimes or a smartphone vibrates with a new message, the brain starts anticipating the momentary distraction that opening an email provides. That expectation, if unsatisfied, can build until a meeting is filled with antsy executives checking their buzzing BlackBerries under the table, even if they know it's probably only their latest fantasy football results. On the other hand, if someone disables the buzzing and thus removes the cue, people can work for hours without thinking to check their inboxes. Scientists have studied the brains of alcoholics, smokers, and overeaters, and have measured how their neurology, the structures of their brains and the flow of neurochemicals inside their skulls, changes as their cravings become ingrained. Particularly strong habits, wrote two researchers at the University of Michigan, produce addiction-like reactions, so that wanting evolves into obsessive craving that can force our brains into autopilot, even in the face of strong disincentives, including loss of reputation, job, home, and family. However, these cravings don't have complete authority over us. As the next chapter explains, there are mechanisms that can help us ignore the temptations. But to overpower the habit, we must recognize which craving is driving the behavior. If we're not conscious of the anticipation, then we're like the shoppers who wander, as if drawn by an unseen force, into Cinnabon. To understand the power of cravings in creating habits, consider how exercise habits emerge. In 2002, researchers at New Mexico State University wanted to understand why people habitually exercise. They studied 266 individuals, most of whom worked out at least 3 times a week. What they found was that many of them had started running or lifting weights almost on a whim, or because they suddenly had free time or wanted to deal with unexpected stresses in their lives. However, the reason they continued, why it became a habit, was because of a specific reward they started to crave. In one group, 92% of people said they habitually exercised because it made them feel good. They grew to expect and crave the endorphins and other neurochemicals a workout provided. In another group, 67% of people said that working out gave them a sense of accomplishment. They had come to crave a regular sense of triumph from tracking their performances. And that self-reward was enough to make the physical activity into a habit. If you want to start running each morning, it's essential that you choose a simple cue, like always lacing up your sneakers before breakfast or leaving your running clothes next to your bed, and a clear reward, such as a midday treat, a sense of accomplishment from recording your miles, or the endorphin rush you get from a jog. But countless studies have shown that a cue and a reward on their own aren't enough for a new habit to last. Only when your brain starts expecting the reward, craving the endorphins or sense of accomplishment, will it become automatic to lace up your jogging shoes each morning. The cue, in addition to triggering a routine, must also trigger a craving for the reward to come. "Let me ask you about a problem I have," I said to Wolfram Schultz, the neuroscientist, after he explained to me how craving emerges. "I have a 2-year-old, and when I'm home feeding him dinner, chicken nuggets and stuff like that, I'll reach over and eat one myself without thinking about it. It's a habit, and now I'm gaining weight." "Everybody does that," Schultz said. He has 3 children of his own, all adults now. When they were young, he would pick at their dinners unthinkingly. "In some ways," he told me, "we're like the monkeys. When we see the chicken or fries on the table, our brains begin anticipating that food, even if we're not hungry. Our brains are craving them. Frankly, I don't even like this kind of food, but suddenly, it's hard to fight this urge. And as soon as I eat it, I feel this rush of pleasure as the craving is satisfied. It's humiliating, but that's how habits work." "I guess I should be thankful," he said, "because the same process has let me create good habits. I work hard because I expect pride from a discovery. I exercise because I expect feeling good afterward. I just wish I could pick and choose better." 4. After their disastrous interview with the Catwoman, Drake Stimson's team at P&G started looking outside the usual channels for help. They began reading up on experiments such as those conducted by Wolfram Schultz. They asked a Harvard Business School professor to conduct psychological tests of Febreze's ad campaigns. They interviewed customer after customer, looking for something that would give them a clue as to how to make Febreze a regular part of consumers' lives. One day, they went to speak with a woman in a suburb near Scottsdale. She was in her 40s with 4 kids. Her house was clean, but not compulsively tidy. To the surprise of the researchers, she loved Febreze. "I use it every day," she told them.
"You do?" Stimson said.
The house didn't seem like the kind of place with smelly problems. There weren't any pets. No one smoked.
"How?
What smells are you trying to get rid of?"
"I don't really use it for specific smells," the woman said. "I mean, you know, I've got boys. They're going through puberty, and if I don't clean their rooms, it smells like a lacquer. But I don't really use it that way. I use it for normal cleaning, a couple of sprays when I'm done in a room. It's a nice way to make everything smell good as a final touch."
They asked if they could watch her clean the house. In the bedroom, she made her bed, plumped the pillows, tightened the sheet's corners, and then took a Febreze bottle and sprayed the unwrinkled comforter. In the living room, she vacuumed, picked up the kids' shoes, straightened the coffee table, and sprayed Febreze on the freshly cleaned carpet.
"It's nice, you know," she said. "Spraying feels like a little mini celebration when I'm done with the room."
At the rate she was using Febreze, Stimson estimated, she would empty a bottle every 2 weeks. P&G had collected thousands of hours of videotapes of people cleaning their homes over the years. When the researchers got back to Cincinnati, some of them spent an evening looking through the tapes. The next morning, one of the scientists asked the entire Febreze team to join him in the conference room. He queued up the tape of one woman, a 26-year-old with 3 children, making a bed. She smoothed the sheets and adjusted a pillow. Then she smiled and left the room.
"Did you see that?"
the researcher asked excitedly. He put on another clip. A younger brunette woman spread out a colorful bedspread, straightened a pillow, and then smiled at her handiwork.
"There it is again," the researcher said.
The next clip showed a woman in workout clothes tidying her kitchen and wiping the counter before easing into a relaxing stretch. The researcher looked at his colleagues.
"Do you see it?" he asked.
"Each of them is doing something relaxing or happy when they finish cleaning," he said.
"We can build off that.
What if Febreze was something that happened at the end of the cleaning routine, rather than the beginning? What if it was the fun part of making something cleaner?" Stimson's team ran one more test. Previously, the product's advertising had focused on eliminating bad smells. The company printed up new labels that showed open windows and gusts of fresh air. More perfume was added to the recipe so that instead of merely neutralizing odors, Febreze had its own distinct scent. Television commercials were filmed of women spraying freshly made beds and spritzing just laundered clothing. The tagline had been, "Gets bad smells out of fabrics." It was rewritten as, "Cleans life's smells." Each change was designed to appeal to a specific daily cue. Cleaning a room, making a bed, vacuuming a rug. In each one, Febreze was positioned as the reward. The nice smell that occurs at the end of a cleaning routine. Most important, each ad was calibrated to elicit a craving, that things will smell as nice as they look when the cleaning ritual is done. The irony is that a product manufactured to destroy odors
was transformed into the opposite. Instead of eliminating scents on dirty fabrics, it became an air freshener used as the finishing touch once things are already clean. When the researchers went back into consumers' homes after the new ads aired and the redesigned bottles were given away, they found that some housewives in the test market had started expecting, craving, the Febreze scent. One woman said that when her bottle ran dry, she squirted diluted perfume on her laundry.
"If I don't smell something nice at the end, it doesn't really seem clean now," she told them.
"The park ranger with a skunk problem sent us in the wrong direction," Stimson told me. "She made us think that Febreze would succeed by providing a solution to a problem. But who wants to admit their house stinks? We were looking at it all wrong. No one craves scentlessness. On the other hand, lots of people crave a nice smell after they've spent 30 minutes cleaning." The Febreze relaunch took place in the summer of 1998. Within 2 months, sales doubled. Within a year, customers had spent more than $230 million on the product. Since then, Febreze has spawned dozens of spin-offs: air fresheners, candles, laundry detergents, and kitchen sprays that all told now account for sales of more than $1 billion per year. Eventually, P&G began mentioning to customers that, in addition to smelling good, Febreze can also kill bad odors. Stimson was promoted, and his team received their bonuses. The formula had worked. They had found simple and obvious cues. They had clearly defined the reward. But only once they created a sense of craving, the desire to make everything smell as nice as it looked, did Febreze become a hit. That craving is an essential part of the formula for creating new habits that Claude Hopkins, the Pepsodent ad man, never recognized. 5. In his final years of life, Hopkins took to the lecture circuit. His talks on the laws of scientific advertising attracted thousands of people. From stages, he often compared himself to Thomas Edison and George Washington and spun out wild forecasts about the future. Flying automobiles featured prominently. But he never mentioned cravings or the neurological roots of the habit loop. After all, it would be another 70 years before the MIT scientists and Wolfram Schultz conducted their experiments. So how did Hopkins manage to build such a powerful toothbrushing habit without the benefit of those insights? Well, it turns out that he actually did take advantage of the principles eventually discovered at MIT and inside Schultz's laboratory, even if nobody knew it at the time. Hopkins' experiences with Pepsodent weren't quite as straightforward as he portrays them in his memoirs. Though he boasted that he discovered an amazing cue in tooth film and bragged that he was the first to offer consumers the clear reward of beautiful teeth, it turns out that Hopkins wasn't the originator of those tactics. Not by a long shot. Consider, for instance, some of the advertisements for other toothpastes that filled magazines and newspapers even before Hopkins knew that Pepsodent existed. "The ingredients of this preparation are especially intended to prevent deposits of tartar from accumulating around the necks of the teeth," read an ad for Dr. Sheffield's creme dentifrice that predated Pepsodent. "Clean that dirty layer. Your white enamel is only hidden by a coating of film," read an advertisement that appeared while Hopkins was looking through his dental textbooks. "Sanitol toothpaste quickly restores the original whiteness by removing film. The charm of a lovely smile depends upon the beauty of your teeth," proclaimed a third ad. "Beautiful, satin-smooth teeth are often the secret of a pretty girl's attractiveness. Use SS White Toothpaste. Dozens of other advertising men had used the same language as Pepsodent years before Hopkins jumped in the game. All of their ads had promised to remove tooth film and had offered the reward of beautiful white teeth. None of them had worked. But once Hopkins launched his campaign, sales of Pepsodent exploded. Why was Pepsodent different? Because Hopkins' success was driven by the same factors that caused Julio the monkey to touch the lever and housewives to spray Febreze on freshly made beds. Pepsodent created a craving. Hopkins doesn't spend any of his autobiography discussing the ingredients in Pepsodent, but the recipe listed on the toothpaste's patent application and company records reveals something interesting. Unlike other pastes of the period, Pepsodent contained citric acid, as well as doses of mint oil and other chemicals. Pepsodent's inventor used those ingredients to make the toothpaste taste fresh, but they had another unanticipated effect as well. They're irritants that create a cool, tingling sensation on the tongue and gums. After Pepsodent started dominating the marketplace, researchers at competing companies scrambled to figure out why. What they found was that customers said that if they forgot to use Pepsodent, they realized their mistake because they missed that cool, tingling sensation in their mouths. They expected, they craved that slight irritation. If it wasn't there, their mouths didn't feel clean. Claude Hopkins wasn't selling beautiful teeth. He was selling a sensation. Once people craved that cool tingling, once they equated it with cleanliness, brushing became a habit. When other companies discovered what Hopkins was really selling, they started imitating him. Within a few decades, almost every toothpaste contained oils and chemicals that caused gums to tingle. Soon, Pepsodent started getting outsold. Even today, almost all toothpastes contain additives with the sole job of making your mouth tingle after you brush. Consumers need some kind of signal that a product is working. Tracy Sinclair, who is a brand manager for Oral-B and Crest Kids Toothpaste, told me, "We can make toothpaste taste like anything. Blueberries, green tea, and as long as it has a cool tingle, people feel like their mouth is clean. The tingling doesn't make the toothpaste work any better. It just convinces people it's doing the job." Anyone can use this basic formula to create habits of her or his own. Want to exercise more? Choose a cue, such as going to the gym as soon as you wake up, and a reward, such as a smoothie after each workout. Then think about that smoothie, or about the endorphin rush you'll feel. Allow yourself to anticipate the reward. Eventually, that craving will make it easier to push through the gym doors every day. Want to craft a new eating habit? When researchers affiliated with the National Weight Control Registry, a project involving more than 6,000 people who have lost more than 30 pounds, looked at the habits of successful dieters, they found that 78% of them ate breakfast every morning, a meal cued by a time of day. But most of the successful dieters also envisioned a specific reward for sticking with their diet, a bikini they wanted to wear, or the sense of pride they felt when they stepped on the scale each day. Something they chose carefully and really wanted. They focused on the craving for that reward when temptations arose, cultivated the craving into a mild obsession. And their cravings for that reward, researchers found, crowded out the temptation to drop the diet. The craving drove the habit loop. For companies, understanding the science of cravings is revolutionary. There are dozens of daily rituals we ought to perform each day that never become habits. We should watch our salt and drink more water. We should eat more vegetables and fewer fats. We should take vitamins and apply sunscreen. The facts could not be more clear on this last front. Dabbing a bit of sunscreen on your face each morning significantly lowers the odds of skin cancer. Yet while everyone brushes their teeth, fewer than 10% of Americans apply sunscreen each day. Why? Because there's no craving that has made sunscreen into a daily habit. Some companies are trying to fix that by giving sunscreens a tingling sensation or something that lets people know they've applied it to their skin. They're hoping it will cue an expectation, the same way the craving for a tingling mouth reminds us to brush our teeth. They've already used similar tactics in hundreds of other products. Foaming is a huge reward, said Sinclair, the brand manager. Shampoo doesn't have to foam, but we add foaming chemicals because people expect it each time they wash their hair. Same thing with laundry detergent and toothpaste. Now every company adds sodium lauryl sulfate to make toothpaste foam more. There's no cleaning benefit, but people feel better when there's a bunch of suds around their mouth. Once the customer starts expecting that foam, the habit starts growing. Cravings are what drive habits. And figuring out how to create a craving makes creating a new habit easier. It's as true now as it was almost a century ago. Every night, millions of people scrub their teeth in order to get a tingling feeling. Every morning, millions put on their jogging shoes to capture an endorphin rush they've learned to crave. And when they get home, after they clean the kitchen or tidy their bedrooms, some of them will spray a bit of Febreze. Chapter 3. The Golden Rule of Habit Change. Why Transformation Occurs. 1. The game clock at the far end of the field says there are 8 minutes and 19 seconds left when Tony Dungy, the new head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, one of the worst teams in the National Football League, not to mention the history of professional football, starts to feel a tiny glimmer of hope. It's late on a Sunday afternoon, November 17th, 1996. The Buccaneers are playing in San Diego against the Chargers, a team that appeared in the Super Bowl the previous year. The Bucs are losing 17-16. They've been losing all game. They've been losing all season. They've been losing all decade. The Buccaneers have not won a game on the West Coast in 16 years, and many of the team's current players were in grade school the last time the Bucs had a victorious season. So far this year, their record is 2-8. In one of those games, the Detroit Lions, a team so bad it would later be described as putting the less in hopeless, beat the Bucs 21-6, and then, 3 weeks later, beat them again 27-0. One newspaper columnist has started referring to the Bucs as America's orange doormat. ESPN is predicting that Dungy, who got his job only in January, could be fired before the year is done. On the sidelines, however, as Dungy watches his team arrange itself for the next play, it feels like the sun has finally broken through the clouds. He doesn't smile. He never lets his emotions show during a game. But something is taking place on the field, something he's been working toward for years. As the jeers from the hostile crowd of 50,000 rain down upon him, Tony Dungy sees something that no one else does. He sees proof that his plan is starting to work. Tony Dungy had waited an eternity for this job. For 17 years, he prowled the sidelines as an assistant coach, first at the University of Minnesota, then with the Pittsburgh Steelers, then the Kansas City Chiefs,
and then back to Minnesota with the Vikings. 4 times in the past decade, he had been invited to interview for head coaching positions with NFL teams. All 4 times, the interviews hadn't gone well. Part of the problem was Dungy's coaching philosophy. In his job interviews, he would patiently explain his belief that the key to winning was changing players' habits. He wanted to get players to stop making so many decisions during a game, he said. He wanted them to react automatically, habitually. If he could instill the right habits, his team would win. Period. Champions don't do extraordinary things, Dungy would explain. They do ordinary things, but they do them without thinking, too fast for the other team to react. They follow the habits they've learned. How, the owners would ask, are you going to create those new habits? Oh, no, he wasn't going to create new habits, Dungy would answer. Players spent their lives building the habits that got them to the NFL. No athlete is going to abandon those patterns simply because some new coach says to. So rather than creating new habits, Dungy was going to change players' old ones. And the secret to changing old habits was using what was already inside players' heads. Habits are a 3-step loop, the cue, the routine, and the reward. And Dungy only wanted to attack the middle step, the routine. He knew from experience that it was easier to convince someone to adopt a new behavior if there was something familiar at the beginning and end. His coaching strategy embodied an axiom, a golden rule of habit change that study after study has shown is among the most powerful tools for creating change. Dungy recognized that you can never truly extinguish bad habits. Rather, to change a habit, you must keep the old cue and deliver the old reward, but insert a new routine. That's the rule. If you use the same cue and provide the same reward, you can shift the routine and change the habit. Almost any behavior can be transformed if the cue and reward stay the same. The golden rule has influenced treatments for alcoholism, obesity, obsessive-compulsive disorders, and hundreds of other destructive behaviors. And understanding it can help anyone change their own habits. Attempts to give up snacking, for instance, will often fail, unless there is a new routine to satisfy old cues and reward urges. A smoker usually can't quit unless she finds some activity to replace cigarettes when her nicotine craving is triggered. 4 times, Dungy explained his habit-based philosophy to team owners. 4 times, they listened politely, thanked him for his time, and then hired someone else. Then, in 1996, the woeful Buccaneers called. Dungy flew to Tampa Bay and once again laid out his plan for how they could win. The day after the final interview, they offered him the job. Dungy's system would eventually turn the Bucs into one of the league's winningest teams. He would become the only coach in NFL history to reach the playoffs in 10 consecutive years, the first African-American coach to win a Super Bowl, and one of the most respected figures in professional athletics. His coaching techniques would spread throughout the league and all of sports. His approach would help illuminate how to remake the habits in anyone's life. But all of that would come later. Today, in San Diego, Dungy just wanted to win. From the sidelines, Dungy looks up at the clock. 8 minutes, 19 seconds remaining. The Bucs have been behind all game and have squandered opportunity after opportunity in typical fashion. If their defense doesn't make something happen right now, this game will effectively be over. San Diego has the ball on their own 20-yard line, and the Chargers quarterback, Stan Humphries, is preparing to lead a drive that
He hopes we'll put the game away. The play clock begins, and Humphreys is poised to take the snap. But Dungy isn't looking at Humphreys. Instead, he's watching his own players align into a formation they have spent months perfecting. Traditionally, football is a game of feints and counterfeints, trick plays and misdirection. Coaches with the thickest playbooks and most complicated schemes usually win. Dungy, however, has taken the opposite approach. He isn't interested in complication or obfuscation. When Dungy's defensive players line up, it is obvious to everyone exactly which play they are going to use. Dungy has opted for this approach because, in theory, he doesn't need misdirection. He simply needs his team to be faster than everyone else. In football, milliseconds matter. So instead of teaching his players hundreds of formations, he has taught them only a handful. But they have practiced over and over until the behaviors are automatic. When his strategy works, his players can move with a speed that is impossible to overcome. But only when it works. If his players think too much or hesitate or second-guess their instincts, the system falls apart. And so far, Dungy's players have been a mess. This time, however, as the Bucks line up on the 20-yard line, something is different. Take Reagan Upshaw, a Buccaneer defensive end who has settled into a three-point stance on the scrimmage line. Instead of looking up and down the line, trying to absorb as much information as possible, Upshaw is looking only at the cues that Dungy taught him to focus on. First, he glances at the outside foot of the opposite lineman. His toes are back, which means he is preparing to block while the quarterback passes. Next, Upshaw looks at the lineman's shoulders, rotated slightly inward, and the space between him and the next player, a fraction narrower than expected. Upshaw has practiced how to react to each of these cues so many times that at this point, he doesn't have to think about what to do. He just follows his habits. San Diego's quarterback approaches the line of scrimmage and glances right, then left, barks the count, and takes the ball. He drops back 5 steps and stands tall, swiveling his head, looking for an open receiver. 3 seconds have passed since the play started. The stadium's eyes and the television cameras are on him. So most observers fail to see what's happening among the Buccaneers. As soon as Humphreys took the snap, Upshaw sprang into action. Within the first second of the play, he darted right across the line of scrimmage, so fast the offensive lineman couldn't block him. Within the next second, Upshaw ran 4 more paces downfield, his steps a blur. In the next second, Upshaw moved 3 strides closer to the quarterback, his path impossible for the offensive lineman to predict. As the play moves into its 4th second, Humphreys, the San Diego quarterback, is suddenly exposed. He hesitates, sees Upshaw from the corner of his eye. And that's when Humphreys makes his mistake. He starts thinking. Humphreys spots a teammate, a rookie tight end named Brian Rocha, 20 yards downfield. There's another San Diego receiver much closer, waving his arms, calling for the ball. The short pass is the safe choice. Instead, Humphreys, under pressure, performs a split-second analysis, cocks his arm, and heaves to Rocha. That hurried decision is precisely what Dungy was hoping for. As soon as the ball is in the air, a Buccaneer safety named John Lynch starts moving. Lynch's job was straightforward. When the play started, he ran to a particular point on the field and waited for his cue. There's enormous pressure to improvise in this situation. But Dungy has drilled Lynch until his routine is automatic. And as a result, when the ball leaves the quarterback's hands, Lynch is standing 10 yards from Rocha, waiting.
As the ball spins through the air, Lynch reads his cues, the direction of the quarterback's face mask and hands, the spacing of the receivers, and starts moving before it's clear where the ball will land. Rocha, the San Diego receiver, springs forward, but Lynch cuts around him and intercepts the pass. Before Rocha can react, Lynch takes off down the field toward the Chargers' end zone. The other Buccaneers are perfectly positioned to clear his route. Lynch runs 10, then 15, then 20, then almost 25 yards before he is finally pushed out of bounds. The entire play has taken less than 10 seconds. 2 minutes later, the Bucs score a touchdown, taking the lead for the first time all game. 5 minutes later, they kick a field goal. In between, Dungy's defense shuts down each of San Diego's comeback attempts. The Buccaneers win, 25-17, one of the biggest upsets of the season. At the end of the game, Lynch and Dungy exit the field together. "It feels like something was different out there," Lynch says as they walk into the tunnel. "We're starting to believe," Dungy replies. 2. To understand how a coach's focus on changing habits could remake a team, it's necessary to look outside the world of sports. Way outside, to a dingy basement on the Lower East Side of New York City in 1934, where one of the largest and most successful attempts at wide-scale habit change was born. Sitting in the basement was a 39-year-old alcoholic named Bill Wilson. Years earlier, Wilson had taken his first drink during officers' training camp in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he was learning to fire machine guns before getting shipped to France and World War I. Prominent families who lived near the base often invited officers to dinner, and one Sunday night, Wilson attended a party where he was served rarebit and beer. He was 22 years old and had never had alcohol before. The only polite thing, it seemed, was to drink the glass served to him. A few weeks later, Wilson was invited to another elegant affair. Men were in tuxedos. Women were flirting. A butler came by and put a Bronx cocktail, a combination of gin, dry and sweet vermouth, and orange juice, into Wilson's hand. He took a sip and felt, he later said, as if he had found the elixir of life. By the mid-1930s, back from Europe, his marriage falling apart and a fortune from selling stocks vaporized, Wilson was consuming 3 bottles of booze a day. On a cold November afternoon, while he was sitting in the gloom, an old drinking buddy called. Wilson invited him over and mixed a pitcher of pineapple juice and gin. He poured his friend a glass. His friend handed it back. He'd been sober for 2 months, he said. Wilson was astonished. He started describing his own struggles with alcohol, including the fight he'd gotten into at a country club that had cost him his job. He had tried to quit, he said, but couldn't manage it. He'd been to detox and had taken pills. He'd made promises to his wife and joined abstinence groups. None of it worked. How, Wilson asked, had his friend done it? "I got religion," the friend said. He talked about hell and temptation, sin and the devil. "Realize you are licked, admit it, and get willing to turn your life over to God." Wilson thought the guy was nuts. "Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion," he later wrote. When his friend left, Wilson polished off the booze and went to bed. A month later, in December 1934, Wilson checked into the Charles B. Towns Hospital for Drug and Alcohol Addictions, an upscale Manhattan detox center.
A physician started hourly infusions of a hallucinogenic drug called belladonna, then in vogue for the treatment of alcoholism. Wilson floated in and out of consciousness on a bed in a small room. Then, in an episode that has been described at millions of meetings in cafeterias, union halls, and church basements, Wilson began writhing in agony. For days, he hallucinated. The withdrawal pains made it feel as if insects were crawling across his skin. He was so nauseous, he could hardly move, but the pain was too intense to stay still. "If there is a God, let him show himself," Wilson yelled to his empty room. "I am ready to do anything, anything." At that moment, he later wrote, a white light filled his room. The pain ceased, and he felt as if he were on a mountaintop, and that a wind not of air but of spirit was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. Slowly, the ecstasy subsided. I lay on the bed, but now for a time I was in another world, a new world of consciousness. Bill Wilson would never have another drink. For the next 36 years, until he died of emphysema in 1971, he would devote himself to founding, building, and spreading Alcoholics Anonymous, until it became the largest, most well-known, and successful habit-changing organization in the world. An estimated 2.1 million people seek help from AA each year, and as many as 10 million alcoholics may have achieved sobriety through the group. AA doesn't work for everyone. Success rates are difficult to measure because of participants' anonymity. But millions credit the program with saving their lives. AA's foundational credo, the famous 12 steps, have become cultural lodestones incorporated into treatment programs for overeating, gambling, debt, sex, drugs, hoarding, self-mutilation, smoking, video game addictions, emotional dependency, and dozens of other destructive behaviors. The group's techniques offer, in many respects, one of the most powerful formulas for change, all of which is somewhat unexpected, because AA has almost no grounding in science or most accepted therapeutic methods. Alcoholism, of course, is more than a habit. It's a physical addiction with psychological and perhaps genetic roots. What's interesting about AA, however, is that the program doesn't directly attack many of the psychiatric or biochemical issues that researchers say are often at the core of why alcoholics drink. In fact, AA's methods seem to sidestep scientific and medical findings altogether, as well as the types of intervention many psychiatrists say alcoholics really need. What AA provides instead is a method for attacking the habits that surround alcohol use. AA, in essence, is a giant machine for changing habit loops. And though the habits associated with alcoholism are extreme, the lessons AA provides demonstrate how almost any habit, even the most obstinate, can be changed. Bill Wilson didn't read academic journals or consult many doctors before founding AA. A few years after he achieved sobriety, he wrote the now famous 12 steps in a rush one night while sitting in bed. He chose the number 12 because there were 12 apostles. And some aspects of the program are not just unscientific. They can seem downright strange. Take, for instance, AA's insistence that alcoholics attend 90 meetings in 90 days, a stretch of time, it appears, chosen at random. Or the program's intense focus on spirituality, as articulated in Step 3, which says that alcoholics can achieve sobriety by making a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. 7 of the 12 steps mention God or spirituality, which seems odd for a program founded by a one-time agnostic who, throughout his life, was openly hostile toward organized religion. AA meetings don't have a prescribed schedule or curriculum. Rather, they usually begin with a member telling his or her story, after which other people can chime in. There are no professionals who guide conversations, and few rules about how meetings are supposed to function. In the past 5 decades, as almost every aspect of psychiatry and addiction research has been revolutionized by discoveries in behavioral sciences, pharmacology, and our understanding of the brain, AA has remained frozen in time. Because of the program's lack of rigor, academics and researchers have often criticized it. AA's emphasis on spirituality, some claimed, made it more like a cult than a treatment. In the past 15 years, however, a reevaluation has begun. Researchers now say the program's methods offer valuable lessons. Faculty at Harvard, Yale, the University of Chicago, the University of New Mexico, and dozens of other research centers have found a kind of science within AA that is similar to the one Tony Dungy used on the football field. Their findings endorse the golden rule of habit change. AA succeeds because it helps alcoholics use the same cues and get the same reward, but it shifts the routine. Researchers say that AA works because the program forces people to identify the cues and rewards that encourage their alcoholic habits, and then helps them find new behaviors. When Claude Hopkins was selling Pepsodent, he found a way to create a new habit by triggering a new craving. But to change an old habit, you must address an old craving. You have to keep the same cues and rewards as before, and feed the craving by inserting a new routine. Take steps 4 to make a searching and fearless inventory of ourselves, and 5 to admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. It's not obvious from the way they're written, but to complete those steps, someone has to create a list of all the triggers for their alcoholic urges, said J. Scott Tonagan, a researcher at the University of New Mexico who has studied AA for more than a decade. When you make a self-inventory, you're figuring out all the things that make you drink, and admitting to someone else all the bad things you've done is a pretty good way of figuring out the moments where everything spiraled out of control. Then, AA asks alcoholics to search for the rewards they get from alcohol. What cravings, the program asks, are driving your habit loop? Often, intoxication itself doesn't make the list. Alcoholics crave a drink because it offers escape, relaxation, companionship, the blunting of anxieties, and an opportunity for emotional release. They might crave a cocktail to forget their worries, but they don't necessarily crave feeling drunk. The physical effects of alcohol are often one of the least rewarding parts of drinking for addicts. There is a hedonistic element to alcohol, said Ulf Mueller, a German neurologist who has studied brain activity among alcoholics. But people also use alcohol because they want to forget something or to satisfy other cravings. And these relief cravings occur in totally different parts of the brain than the craving for physical pleasure. In order to offer alcoholics the same rewards they get at a bar, AA has built a system of meetings and companionship, the sponsor each member works with, that strives to offer as much escape, distraction, and catharsis as a Friday night bender. If someone needs relief, they can get it from talking to their sponsor or attending a group gathering rather than toasting a drinking buddy. AA forces you to create new routines for what to do